It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacy's here. Jeff's here. We're joined by Ron Amadio from Ars Technica. You know what else is here? The new Jamboard's here. We'll talk about Google's whiteboard. Cost $5,000. A new product from Google that advertisers are going to love, but end users might not be too happy about. And we'll visit Mark Zuckerberg's dorm room. It's all ahead on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 406, recorded Wednesday, May 24th, 2017. Call me Mr. Pruneface. This Week in Google is brought to you by 23andMe, an online genetic analysis company that helps you understand your 23 pairs of chromosomes, your DNA. Get over 75 genetic reports today and start exploring your DNA at 23andMe.com/twit. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/twig and entering the promo code TWIG. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/twig. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest news from anything we want to talk about. Ron Amadio is joining us from Ars Technica. Great to see you, Ron. I just want you to know you have permission to talk about anything you want.
Okay, cool.
Notice he's not going to give me that permission.
Jeff Jarvis does not have permission to talk about anything.
No, I don't.
No, of course you do. It's buzzmachine.com Jarvis. That's his blog. He's also, of course, a great writer and professor of journalism at the City University of New York in the graduate school there. Nice to see you, Jeff.
Always good to see you, boss.
And from Austin, Texas. We missed her last week. Stacy Higginbotham.
I was here last week.
You were here, but you weren't in the room with us. If you had only been in the room with us, I would have remembered you.
Wow.
No, I remember you. But it was just, it was so nice because we had Jason and we had Jeff, and I just felt like,
saying we missed having you there.
Yeah, we would
keep digging. Keep digging, Theo.
I get away with nothing with Stacey. She knows exactly what I'm thinking.
No, you don't. No, none of us does.
Do you want to buy a $5,000 Jamboard? And oh, by the way, you need to buy a $1,600 stand. And if you want to use it, you have to pay $600 a year for service.
Oh.
Yeah, but that's the CTO's problem. That's fine.
I want one.
I want one for the school.
Yeah. So this is a new whiteboard from Google that they announced some time ago, but it is now available as of today. It is competing directly with Microsoft's Surface Hub, which is also a giant screen whiteboard. But there are also a lot of lesser known devices. Schools use these and others. The difference here is this is really tightly integrated with Google services. In fact, you have to have a G Suite subscription just to use it.
Oh.
Jeff will be so thrilled.
Something you can
finally, if I spend $7,500, I get some privilege for having a G Suite account.
Yay.
Oh, thank you very much, Google.
Yay. So who wants to? I like the big, by the way, the big crayon pencils it comes with. And that
I think
thing
you should make that your desk.
That thing on the right is an eraser. It's very Fisher Price.
Yes,
that's what I was thinking. I'm like, it's like my daughter's easel from when she was like three.
But I think this is Google trying to make this friendly, right?
Yeah, well, it's also cool accessible design.
Right.
The cool thing about it is it's like fully like Google Docsified, where like you can have mirrors of it open and everyone can see what everyone else is doing in real time. So like if you don't want to walk up to the board and draw on it, you will have a copy of the board on your tablet and you can like draw on it with your finger. And everybody everywhere gets like a mirrored version of the Jamboard, whether you're in the room or not.
Yeah, if you're sitting there with a Chromebook, you can throw stuff up on the board, right?
And, yeah. Yeah, it looks because it's like totally vertically integrated because it's Google hardware and Google software. You can get all sorts of fun little tricks like that actually work, I guess.
Now, we were playing this video earlier, and Paul Theriot said, there's something about video when you draw on something that Microsoft's had the same problem with their Surface stuff. There seems to be more latency than there is. So I don't know how much latency there is, but Google says, oh, no, it's very direct drive when you're writing on it.
Ooh, finger erasing? Finger drawing.
Ooh. Or big, fat pencil drawing. Oh, look, it turned it into a circle. I wonder.
I wonder if it's auto-doodle.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to use auto-doodle.
I bet it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, here we're going to see it. Yeah.
Nope.
Is that a baseball mitt?
It's a turkey. I don't know what it is. It's a shell.
It's a shell.
Cover that bad drawing with a real shell. Okay. And I mean, I suppose for a corporate device, this is, a boardroom device, that's probably a good price, $5,000.
Yeah. These are real boardroom looking people. It actually looks more like SMB kind of thing. You would still pay for this. I mean, it's cheap for corporate boards.
Right.
Okay. So
this is exactly and designers too, right? These people are hip.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should make Twig
this
truly
is exactly
multimedia.
What would be at Condé Nast headquarters.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's they love this boardroom stuff.
Yeah. All boardrooms have this stuff. Now somebody was telling me that one of the things Microsoft's Surface Hub does that this doesn't, that should do, there, Microsoft's a little bit more cognizant of what corporations need. For instance, when you walk out of the room, the Surface Hub erases itself immediately so that nobody can steal your brilliant ideas, things like that. I don't know. So it's you can get it in carmine red, cobalt blue, or graphite gray. Of course, everybody's going to buy the red.
Blue.
Blue
is the best color.
Blue is the best color. What are you, in grade school? Blue is the best color. Red. Everybody knows red's the best color. Anyway.
I was going to go with boring executive gray.
Yeah. Well, you can each of you can have your own. $5,000. Wall mount included, but if you want that rolling stand, and really, I think that's the fun thing is you roll it around. That's another $1,200. They are giving out deals. What they don't mention here, I wish they would, maybe I have to click through, is that there is a yearly fee. They're given a deal on the yearly fee. It's only $300 management and support fee if you buy it right now. But eventually, it'll be $600, $50 a month.
Yes. What do you get for that?
Do you get the Google G Suite apps?
No, it's a management and support fee. I don't know. They're not clear about that.
Maybe they're concerned about them breaking down, and they want to make sure the overhead's in place for a long period of time.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
At the World Trade Center, they have like TVs in every meeting room, and they're pretty much useless. If they ran some kind of software and were touchscreen, that would be at least a little bit better than these giant screens they mount on the wall because they look good. I don't know.
It's like a smart board. It's like any other kind of board. You draw on it. You can save it. You can print it. Other people can share it.
You can show video and things on it, right? You do video conferencing on it?
Yes, they show video conferencing, so you can do that. But I don't think you can just like play. Can you just play YouTube videos? I don't think it's like a real operating system. I don't know.
Really? But you said you could throw things up from your Chromebook. Could you throw a video?
Yeah, it's got.
Yeah, you can Chromecast.
Google Cast.
If I'm in a classroom. Well,
no, you can
room.
Google Cast. You're right. Built-in Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, NFC, HDMI, and Google Cast. So you could. But I don't know if you could. I don't know. I guess I have to buy one and find out.
You could always Lisa. Donate it when you're done to a great school.
To a school.
University like mine.
Yeah.
No, or use it as university. One of the TVs next to you, and then you can draw rabbit ears on people and mustaches.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Well, I can kind of do that now because I've got a Surface Studio. So I can, I have to have the ability to telestrate on my screen,
Oh, nice.
Ron's onto something here. You can start drawing on our screen.
I would like to draw on your face, though. Yeah.
I already have a mustache.
No, but I put devil horns. No, but I'm not. I mean, this is similar, really. It's a little smaller, but this is kind of the same idea. I can
What if you, again, what if you made Windows Jamboard your desk?
Yeah, I don't think it's designed to be your desk. It's designed to be on the wall.
That's the Surface table. That'll be your desk.
Yeah.
That's true. That's
We've
true.
Probably spent more time than this deserves, but I just...
That's true. I'm gadget freaks. We want it.
It's pretty cool. I kind of would like to have it.
I think I applied for beta on it and never heard
I did
back.
Too, yeah.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, so there you go.
Did you guys hear back?
No. Nope. And now you can all buy it.
That's pretty rude, Google. I do have an apps account after all.
We use a chalkboard. In fact, I've always on TV used a chalkboard because I like it because it's so low tech that I like the idea of having a green chalkboard and chalk, and I make all our hosts draw on it. This is more like, oh, obviously you're gonna have a smart board. No, I want to be low tech.
I have a whiteboard, so
whiteboard's
low tech
good.
With you.
Whiteboard's not great for TV because it's so bright, and that's I don't know if we could actually use the Jamboard on TV. We always had trouble shooting smart boards. But that was a long time.
And Jeff.
And Jeff. Yeah, he's too white.
Yes, that's right. I am a human whiteboard. Draw on me.
YouTube's virtual reality platform is adding shared rooms that will let people view 360-degree video together. This is part of Daydream VR. Actually, you know... This is like Spaces. Facebook showed this at their developer conference. Google has now, and they didn't. I don't know if they showed this at the VR talk at Google I/O. I don't think so.
No, they didn't.
Yeah.
But that reminds me of Turntable FM. Those little people. Do you remember? Being
oh
in-
yeah,
yeah.
I was like, oh.
Yeah, you'd go in and you'd play your music, and then people would applaud in the audience, and it looks just like that, doesn't it? Share a 3D.
I'm not sure I get this.
You can also you can customize your human-looking avatar. They'll speak out loud in real time. So it's kind of like avatar chat, which we used to use back in 1998 on Tech TV. voice will be the way people express themselves in VR, says YouTube product lead Aaron Teague.
These 360 video really things. Go ahead.
No, you go.
These 360 video things are like the worst because they take away all of like the director's cinematography and everything. Like you have no idea where to look. So I just sit there and like spin constantly when I'm in these things because I'm always worried about like what am I missing, what's happening behind me. It's way nicer to just have like a real regular video in front of you. I never get it, and they always need to be like ridiculously high resolution, and they're just weird.
So
you've got FOMO for VR 360.
Yeah, basically.
We're sometime around now. I remember Second Life was supposed to release a 360-degree VR version of Second Life called Sansar.
Second Life needs a Second Life.
It would be Third Life, but it's not out yet. But it was supposed to come out right around now. I
think. You know any? Tell me, Leo, you're not still in Second Life.
No, I have. By the way, though, I love my name in Second Life, Pruneface Spatula. What? No, if you remember, you couldn't just pick your name like be Leo Laporte. You had to pick from like a menu of first and last names. And I think that was the auto-generated one, and I liked it so much I just said, well, I'll keep that. Pruneface.
We can call you Spoonface or Pruneface.
Pruneface.
Like.
Call me Pruneface. Well, wasn't he
like a
Batman villain?
Dick Tracy character.
Yeah, or it was. It was a Dick Tracy villain, yeah.
It was, all right, yeah.
Yeah. You really are old.
I was like, wow.
Back in the big war, in the Great War, we used to read Dick Tracy.
That was one of my first EW covers, Dick Tracy movie.
Oh, with Warren Beatty.
Warren Beatty?
And Madonna.
Beatty, yeah.
And Madonna. Yep. That's where they kind of had a little thing.
Everyone had a theme with Warren Beatty.
Everybody
that was
had
his
a thing with Madonna. There wasn't anything special about that either. Let's talk about, I know what you want to talk about, Ron Amadio. One of the things that was big at Google I/O, or many new things, but all incremental improvements, but self-driving cars. In fact, there is some self-driving car news. Ford has fired its three-year CEO, Mark Hurd, and replaced...
Fields.
Mark Hurd was the HP CEO. Oh, yeah. I confused the two. And replaced him with the head of Jim Hackett, the head of their Ford's autonomous car vehicle project. Although
even though he's the head of the autonomous vehicle project, he came from Steelcase.
He's a Mr. Fix-It.
Which was an office. Don't they make those big file cabinets in the offices, Steelcase?
Chairs on wheels, cubicles.
So it wasn't exactly a high-tech company.
Steelcase is actually very high-tech.
Oh.
Believe it or not. So Steelcase has been very forward-looking in how to embed technology into its products for productivity and workers. They have a really smart lab group. So I know. It's
how do
a surprise.
You know that?
Because we
Stacey knows.
When we were doing our IoT conference, we had someone from Steelcase slated to come. Smart fellow.
He's also a turnaround guy, though, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, we got to spend a lot of time with Ford's previous CEO, Alan Mulally, who I had huge respect for and who really took Ford from a struggling company. They never took money from the federal government. The other members of the big three did. Ford really
improved quality.
Yeah. And turned it around. And then this guy comes along in 3 years and Ford's, you know, moving back to Mexico and just all sorts of troubles.
Where did Mulally go?
Well, I think he just retired. I think there was a rumor that he was going to serve in Trump's cabinet. I don't know if he pulled himself out of consideration, but I only heard the rumor briefly. I don't know what he does right now. Former president and CEO of Ford. He retired in 2014. He was at Boeing, where he had really done some amazing things at Boeing. He's a really smart guy. I guess I guess he's just living life.
The Google board of directors. That sounds
fun. Right. He's on the Google board. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Very smart guy. And who did a great job. And I guess his successor, not so great.
What do you think it pays to be on the Google board of directors?
Oh, lots.
it should be in their 14.
That's what I think.
What is it? Is it the 14A? 14K? What is your... It's in your definitive proxy statement issued once a year.
Yeah, they're K.
So,
let me just see. I want to know what the board...
90,000 to 379,000.
That's what I would have guessed. That's a big range. I would have guessed six figures, but... yeah, it's good money if you can get it. And you don't work, you know, but a few times a year.
I would, believe me, Google, I'll take it.
They send you a plane. You can get a ride.
I'll do it. I'll just business class is fine. I'll just do a regular. I'll fly commercial. I'll do it tomorrow.
Let's see. Here we go.
We'll work on getting this accounts thing fixed. Okay.
So, Jeff, I was wondering if maybe it's because a lot of the services Google provides to free people and to the free customers
involves them. Yes.
Okay, but you pay for your accounts.
I know. I'm sorry. Just stop.
It could be that they can't. They scan all those emails, but if you pay for it, they don't actually look inside your emails because corporations would be obviously mad. So I wonder if that's one of the challenges they face when trying to divvy that up. This is just pure speculation. But
you're making excuses for them, Stacey.
I'm not making excuses. I'm just. You know,
Stacey. Let me be angry.
Yes. I am also angry. I have accounts and I'm also like, oh, I can't put you together. So.
Yep.
Anywho, Google's self-driving unit, Waymo, is worth, it turns out, way more than any of the other big three. More than GM. More than Uber, more than Tesla. This was a story from a couple of days ago based on an analyst from Morgan Stanley who said that its value should be around $70 billion. That's more than a tenth of Alphabet's overall market value. Do you agree with that, Ron Amadio? That seems like a lot.
This does seem like Alphabet's next like good business venture because this really is something that like could change the world, and Google's been doing it for longer than anyone else, so you know, just kind of naturally they're ahead of everybody else. I think even who's the turncoat that went to Uber and is getting sued, whatever his name is. Yeah. He recently admitted that Waymo was like 5 years ahead of Uber in terms of technology. And I mean, that probably lines up with when they started, too. Waymo's just the furthest ahead from everybody, and they want to license it to car manufacturers, and they have a ride-sharing trial going on in Arizona now, I think. And it's just something where there's a huge market for it if you can get it right, and plenty of companies will like pay for the technology, or you can start your own ride-sharing service. They just partnered with Lyft, I think, for a ride-sharing service. I'm not sure what Lyft is going to contribute to that partnership, but okay.
Look at these numbers. This is from Forbes in February. This is the number of autonomous miles driven. Waymo has driven 97% of all autonomous miles, beating everybody. Tesla, GM, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Ford, Nissan, Delphi, Bosch, by a long shot. This is in 2016.
And so when Uber comes along and thinks, oh, we can do that.
And look how hard it's been for Uber.
Is tremendous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What this number doesn't include is what they call disengagements, which is when a human driver has had to take over for the autonomous vehicle. And Google also leads, Waymo also leads in that regard, by far the fewest disengagements. Waymo's test drivers have to disengage about once every 5,000 miles. BMW, 638, Tesla, 182, Mercedes-Benz, once every 600. Mercedes-Benz had 336 disengagements over 673 miles. That's like once every 2 miles.
So I wonder if my cruise control could match that. Just see how straight down the road the car will go.
This doesn't include, however, autopilot miles on Teslas, which are 200 million. I mean, Teslas have Tesla has a lot of data about self-driving cars, but their autopilot isn't really full autonomy. So it's not under California law. It's not autonomous. So in fact,
lots of cars have similar features. Yeah. I feel like they're pretty close, and that gets really hyped up because it's Tesla. But Waymo has the largest self-driving fleet on earth, or at least they will when they get their Arizona thing up and running. But I think the big deal about Waymo is that they make their own hardware now. So it's pretty easy. Well, it's relatively easy to kind of get like a self-driving car project up and running just by going to Velodyne is the company and buying their like out-of-the-box LiDAR solutions. You see these on Ford cars a lot. They kind of look like little Coke cans. The new one looks like a hockey puck. That's like if you look at the Prius, the like first Google self-driving Prius, it had like a big fat like trash can on the roof. That was another Velodyne sensor, where Waymo makes like all their own hardware now.
And as a result, it costs them about a tenth what it costs everybody else. Here's some video spotted by a Mac Rumors reader of the Apple Lexus self-driving car. Apple has a fleet of five or six of these. And yeah, see that big coffee can on the roof? That's the off-the-shelf LiDAR that you were talking about.
Yeah. I don't get why they identified this as an Apple car.
Yeah, it doesn't say Apple on it.
Right, and why would it? And how would you ever know, unless you talk to the people? Or maybe they saw it leave Apple headquarters.
Yeah, because this
driver was particularly well-dressed in black.
It was on an iPhone.
They confirmed it with Apple?
Oh, that would be called reportage.
Apple would ever say anything.
Well, I know, but you know.
It's using the Velodyne 64-channel LiDAR, as you said, Ron.
$75,000.
Wow. But Waymo is making it for what? A tenth, they said.
But that's what Google does. Yeah. I mean, Google builds its own hardware. It figures out how something works, figures out how it can optimize it, and then boom.
Yeah, the trash can model is really old, like a couple years old. So it's pretty expensive. Velodyne has smaller, cheaper ones, but the channel is what's important. When they say 64 channels, like you know when they show you the self-driving car thing, they have rings around the car that does like a 3D scan of the
earth. Yeah, what it's
the
seeing.
Channels is how many rings you get.
Ah,
and you can make it cheaper by having less channels. Because like they have robots that they have vacuum cleaners that work on LiDAR because they're one channel. Mm-hmm. And you can get those for $500. So what really matters is how many channels are you doing per like dollar? Because anybody can make them cheaper. It's can you make it cheap and good?
Meanwhile, Uber has pissed off Pittsburgh, which was the pilot city for its self-driving vehicles. This article from the Cecilia Kang in the New York Times says Uber has reneged. They promised free rides in the driverless vehicle. Well, they're not really driverless. There's a driver, but in the self-driving cars. Nope, they started charging for them. It withdrew support from Pittsburgh's
Uber.
Is just like, it's just a nonstop junk show, crap show. It also withdrew support from Pittsburgh's application for a $50 million federal grant. It hasn't created the jobs it proposed in the neighborhood that houses its autonomous car testing track. Pittsburgh's pissed. In fact, it's an issue in the mayoral primary, which is going on right now. One of the candidates, the guy who won, actually called Uber a stain on the city.
Wow.
Oh, Lord.
Has Uber done anything right?
I was going to say, did we talk about its, it's right, route-based pricing, route-based pricing?
Yeah, driver's real happy about that now. No, we haven't. Let's talk about it. This was this discovered Friday, or announced?
I think it was discovered and then Uber admitted confirmed to it and talked about it.
So they're basically charging what it thinks you're willing to pay. They have a lot of data, right? And they're not afraid to use it. This is a story from Bloomberg. Uber drivers have been complaining that the gap between the fare a rider pays and what the driver gets paid is getting wider. Uber has finally provided an explanation, according to Bloomberg. It's charging some passengers more because it needs the money.
Yeah. Didn't they lose $2 billion?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a big money loser. Yeah. They're worth almost $70 billion, but they lose money at an almost stunning clip. The route-based pricing charges customers based on what their data model predicts they're willing to pay. Not like a cab company, which, you know, calculates it on mileage and time.
And how historically Uber had done it. I think what's really interesting here is we don't know what data factors in. Uber gave us some examples. But what about, like, I think about this in the context of IoT and privacy and how much data we're really giving about ourselves in all sorts of crazy ways. And I am freaked out by the idea of discriminatory pricing, it's just...
It's reverse redlining.
You'll never get a deal anymore, basically. And so I'm like, oh, this is exciting and fun. Amazon does the same thing based on some of its products on like
Amazon has surge pricing. I don't think people know that, but pricing will change from day to day on stuff, depending on...
Well, Amazon doesn't even put prices on books in the store, the physical stores they have.
Really? How do you know what you're going to pay?
Because you either check on an app, on your app, or you take it up and scan it. But because prices change all the time, pricing.
Paul Thurrott's daughter was at the Amazon store. Apparently there's one near him in Massachusetts, and they won't take cash. And she's too young to have a credit card, so she couldn't buy anything.
One day she'll get a chip implanted in her wrist.
Yeah. What scares me about the Uber pricing thing is that, like, I mix personal and business on my Uber account because, you know, it's part of my job. I was in I.O. last week, and you pretty much have to Uber all around San Francisco. So because I use it at work and I'm just like, yeah, it's a business expense, sure, whatever. Now when I have to use, like, Uber back home, it's going to cost me more money.
Yeah, maybe.
That stinks.
Oh. One of the examples Uber's head of product Daniel Graff, gave Bloomberg. Somebody traveling from a wealthy neighborhood to another Tony spot might be asked to pay more than a person heading to a poorer part of town. What? I guess, hey, it's capitalism, right? They've got the data. The reason cab companies never did it, they just didn't know.
Which is why I'm like, and imagine now if they get more data about you. So let's say they see
he's
your
a doctor.
Data.
Yeah, he's a doctor. Charge him twice as much.
Yeah, or this person really isn't going to walk, or God help you.
So what's wrong with that?
You know, in a capitalistic society, nothing. But it does signal the end of, and this is something that's important for everyone to realize. Even businesses should have, will end up having this.
This is how tax works. You pay more tax if you're rich. Well, actually, you don't. But in theory, you pay more tax if you're rich.
It's the idea that you'll never get a deal. The other issue, because people love deals, they really do. But the other issue is there's a definite power imbalance over who has access and control yes. of your data.
He
and
who
for
has
how long.
The data wins. Mm-hmm. We're rapidly approaching that world. And by the way, who has yes. the most data? Google.
Google.
Yep.
More than anybody.
Followed by Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon has a lot of data, but certainly commerce data. but as we've
Facebook.
Learned, Facebook.
Doesn't Facebook have more data about you than Amazon, you really? Know,
I think Google gets more data than anybody because they own the phone platform as well as the desktop platform.
All your curiosities, all your email.
They know everything. They got your they got know everything. Everything. Facebook is limited
so
to what you share
versus,
on Facebook.
Versus Amazon. Stacey nominated Amazon. I think I'd go with Facebook.
Amazon knows everything you buy if you buy everything at Amazon.
If you buy everything at Amazon.
Google is
Google,
just...
But Google will soon know more about that than
Amazon. Look what Google just announced at their ad conference. And this is kind of the holy grail for advertisers. Advertisers
very
buy,
much so.
Yeah, this advertisers like buy ads on Twit, for instance. But what they don't know is, well, we know we give you a tracking code, so we know if you immediately bought something because you heard an ad on Twit. That's why we always say use our offer code TWIG. But that doesn't. But if Ford used to advertise here, what Ford would love to know is, did those ads on Twit help sell cars at the dealership? Google says now. They will help advertisers by tracking offline credit card use to show that online ads work. Now, they do say they're anonymizing. They're double anonymizing it. That's really good.
Oh.
Twice as good.
Does that mean it takes 8 pieces of data? Or does it take 16?
I do. I feel like Google's pretty good at data science. They understand the problem with anonymizing. However,
okay. That doesn't mean... They don't necessarily know that we understand it. And so they can say it's double anonymized. And to them, that means something. And they're like, that's not very effective. But to us, we're like, ooh.
They say, quote, Google ad interactions will be done in a secure and privacy safe way and only report on aggregated and anonymized store sales to protect your customer data. So this is because they have Android Pay. Look, they have Android. They have Android Pay. They have sales receipts that you get emailed. And by the way, that's more and more the case. Amazon's not even close. And Facebook's even farther afield. Because if people start, and Apple, by the way, with Apple Pay might have more information, but they don't have anywhere near the other stuff. Google's the winner in this one, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. This is as you said, it's the holy grail. They've been wanting accountability. I mean, it's still not going to be perfect because you might have seen 5 ads for cars. I mean, how many things did I look at like cars before I finally bought mine?
But that's where it's...
How many cars do you buy with a credit card?
I put $5,000 for the down payment. You bet, so I got miles.
Oh, okay. No, I'm just like, wait a second. Who buys a car with a credit card?
So bank data probably, privacy there is probably more protected, right?
But it's not. In the end, what you're going back to is you're simply saying that person X who saw this ad bought this thing. We're not telling you who person X is. We're not telling you what they bought. We're just saying, hello, advertiser, you get extra credit.
The company says advertisers have measured some 5 billion store visits through AdWords in the past 3 years. Deep learning is helping it predict store visits in historically difficult to measure, densely packed places like multi-story malls. Oh, Tango could help here, couldn't it?
Well, you also just have the phone telling you you're there.
Right.
You have the location. Then you have the payoff of they actually made a purchase, and you have what ad they saw on what media.
They say they can track, get this, about 70% of all credit and debit card transactions in the U.S.,
Jesus. Oh, the Germans are just going to completely freak out.
Hey, machine learning is powerful.
It should also freak out Facebook and Amazon and everybody else because it freaks me out because I can't sell an ad that can give you that kind of information.
No, exactly. It freaks out media. that's who's going to mostly freak out, is because we can't promise that. That's a cost per sale ad.
Yeah.
And you can sell that.
Oh, you can sell that. Although a savvy advertiser, I would be quick to point out, will value the unique relationship that a podcaster can bring with its audience.
And
you
can
never get from an AdWord banner ad. And the trust.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right?
That's true. Well, they could hear it about this, so they could hear about something from you, right? Oh, Leo said this. Let me Google it and see. And then, boom, Google claims it.
That's
You're
okay.
done.
That's okay. The advertisers know. You know what I love? My favorite thing is when an advertiser comes to us and, after a long ad campaign and says, and this happens all the time, it didn't work. We cancel. And then they come crawling back 3 months later when they realize their sales have plummeted because it was working. They just weren't able to measure
it. Have the accountability. Right.
Yeah. Someday that'll happen. No, it has happened once or twice. Google attribution is what they call this.
This is a big deal in the industry.
Is it?
Big deal.
I thought it was when I read it. And only Google can do this. Nobody else can do this. I mean, Amazon could do
Apple
it in the
Apple
small.
Pay.
Yeah. The other companies could do it in the small universe that they operate in, but can Apple Pay claim to be able to see 70% of all credit card transactions? I don't
think so. Well, and also, how many ads does Google see? So if you just simply are using the Google ad ecosystem, they see most ads. They know who clicked on that ad, who saw that, or who saw that. Here's the interesting part is, it's no longer pay-per-click, right? Pay-per-sale. So whether you clicked or not, doesn't matter so much. So that could change the essence of what ads look like, how they operate.
So remember, Google announced this in a forum where the audience was very receptive to advertisers.
Right. Yeah, this was not in the I.O. keynote.
This was not at I.O. This was later. But some of us are looking at this. This is the slide they put up, Google attribution. Google attribution takes in data across AdWords, Google Analytics, and double-click search without any additional tagging. They don't have to. They know all about you. Now we're this is what people have been telling me for a long time about Google. Now we're seeing the fruits of all of this, right? For instance, the robots, the CAPTCHA thing, I am not a robot, that's disappearing now. Because they started with just the checkbox. Now it's completely disappearing because Google knows who you are. If you're using your computer and your browser, they know exactly who you are and that you're not a robot. They have enough. They've been collecting enough signals for long enough to know exactly.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I get it. Sometimes to get a different experience, I'll turn on incognito.
You'll see it all
there.
More.
I get it.
Yeah.
Well, so that's again why I thought I/O was actually a really good keynote, and everyone else was like blah blah boring. Google is mastering context. Because it's applying machine learning. So it's applying. Notice one of the things it's looking at is nearby location data to get data about people visiting stores.
Yes.
That's contextual information just being thrown from your phone. I mean,
It's what we always thought, that the data smog that's coming off of you all the time would become more and more valuable with modeling and artificial intelligence and deep data analysis.
It's just not valuable to you.
We're entering that world. Yeah, well, but you're giving it off and somebody's capitalizing on it.
Right.
Yikes.
Oh, so are we going to move to another topic?
I'll do an ad, but go ahead.
I need to do a correction first.
Please.
So I stupidly Googled, director compensation. That means people, if you're at the director level at Google. So Alan Mulally, when he was appointed to the board in 2014... he will receive an annual initial grant of $1 million in Google stock, an annual equity award of $350,000 with a $75,000 cash retainer and reimbursement of expenses.
Yeah.
Google, I'll do it for less.
Really. Cut it in half.
I'm a bargain less.
I know a number of people who serve on boards. That's a very, because nobody does just one board. You do four or five. You're making a couple of mil a year. It's hardly working. It's a great gig. Unfortunately, you have to be a successful
liability.
CEO first.
Yeah, I know.
But don't they need more professors and podcasts on boards to represent the real people?
The people.
The people.
The people.
I don't think the professors and media professors represent the people at this moment
in
time.
They do, Stacey, a lot more than IoT podcasters.
I am not putting myself out there and as a board, although as a woman, I would argue that I could do fairly well.
You know, I would actually put you on a board because, yes, you represent the distaff side.
Awesome. All right.
I don't know. Is that I should probably look up the etymology of that because it's probably incredibly insulting.
You know what, Leo?
It doesn't matter, right? You just know that I'm going to be that way no matter what. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, yeah, I mean,
distaff.
I'm like, eh.
Oh, it is. It's incredibly insulting.
Yes, it is. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to tell
him.
He doesn't
need to know. It's a stick or spindle onto which wool or flax is wound for spinning or of or concerning women.
You can call me hysterical later and we'll call it a draw.
Lord above. I am such an old school fart now. I didn't used to be this way. I used to be liberated and woke.
No.
I'm using words like distaff.
Okay.
I didn't mean to refer to you as a stick or spindle into which wool or flax is wound for spinning.
Again, you can add it to your list of things you shouldn't call Stacey.
Do not say distaff.
Honey,
Stacey.
Distaff.
Yes, honey. Distaff. And never refer to opening your kimono.
Oh,
that is wrong.
Yes. Or blowing smoke up your skirt.
That's very wrong.
How about the camel's nose under the tent? Can you say that?
I think that's okay.
I'm just,
Ron is like, hey, can we talk about Google now?
I'm just teasing you. We're going to take a break. Ron Amadio is here. Great to have him from Ars Technica. Literally the place I go first every day for the best tech reporting out there. And Ron does a great job covering Android. But all of the Ars team is fantastic. Just hike. You're the New York Times of tech sites. Really. Seriously. Great stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've always loved ours. And also with us, it's, of course, Jeff Jarvis. He's not... What is the opposite of distaff? He's the opposite of distaff. He's on staff. And Stacey Higginbotham, who is just great and puts up with me.
Forgiving.
Thank
gracious.
You. You're very gracious. You're very gracious. So I learned the other day that I'm a man. And I have wet earwax. But it's just a few of the things I learned from 23andMe. I love 23andMe, an online genetic analysis company that helps you understand your 23 pairs of chromosomes. That's where the name comes from. It's your DNA. I should log in. Let me log into my 23andMe because I can show you some of the things that I know about myself, my ethnicity. I found relatives, which is super cool. I found a second cousin because they do is among other things, they will match you up with other 23andMe. And you have to give them permission, of course. You have total control of your privacy. But they'll match you up with other 23andMe customers who have genes similar enough that they must be related. And they will say, oh, this person, this is mine. See, DNA relatives. This person's probably related to you. It's so cool. So Anthony Jacoby is a second cousin. And you know what? I know he is because that's my grandmother's maiden name. Is that not awesome?
Wow.
And it's based on... So all you do, it's very simple. They send you a little vial and you spit into it. I mean, it's not a blood draw or anything like that. It's very, very easy to do. They will give you reports like your ancestry reports. A lot of people love these. But yeah, see, order, spit, and discover. That's the three steps. because
Expectorate.
And by the way, the other thing is I did this a long time ago, maybe a couple of years ago, but there's always new stuff in here. For instance, I just am learning now about my maternal haplogroup, which is U5A1B1. So I can see, look at this, is so cool. Migrations of my maternal line. This is my mom. You know, this is my mother's side. I can go back to 180,000 years ago. We came from Central East Africa. migrated up to into the Middle East, and then up and into Europe 47,000 years ago. That's from my haplogroup. That is fascinating. You can learn more. It's one of the oldest haplogroups in Europe. The common ancestor of U5A1 was a woman who likely lived in Europe during the Ice Age, 17,000 years ago. That's my great-great-great-something, grandma. It's not completely uncommon. About 1 in 169 23andMe customers are in this same group. So is the Cheddar Man. I'm very proud to be related to the Cheddar Man. This is England's oldest skeleton.
I was like, you're related to a cheesemonger?
This is hysterical. His maternal haplogroup, also U5A. What? Anyway, we could to do this with your kids because the educational part of this is fantastic. You also get traits, things like facial features. You know, which based, you know, I have a cleft chin, cheek dimples, a unibrow, and a widow's peak. That's right. Nailed it. And you can see what earlobe type you have. All of this from spitting into a little vial. It's 23andMe. 75 online genetic reports, categories like ancestry, wellness, traits, even health. You can learn more about who you are. You want to know if I have any Neanderthal? Sure you do. Do you have any Neanderthal in you? Would you know that? Where do I find the Neanderthal? It's probably in the ancestry report. Yeah.
The ancestry report is even better. Now it's telling me the ancestry, the ethnicity of them.
Isn't this cool?
My numbers. How many relatives I have in here. And then it's breaking down the numbers.
Yeah. So I'm actually a little less Neanderthal than most 623andMe customers. I'm a little bit more polished and refined. However, I'm in seventh place out of my family and friends, which is funny. That's what I love about this. You constantly get new information all the time as we learn more and more about what this means. There's a carrier status. 23andMe's carrier status reports meet FDA requirements. This is what we were talking about. So you could find out if you're a carrier for certain inherited conditions, things like cystic fibrosis, hereditary hearing loss. Oh, I don't want to look at that one. I know I'm losing my hearing. Understand what makes you you. It's just fascinating. Get over 75 genetic reports and start exploring your DNA today. 23andme.com/twit. That's the number 23andme, 23andme.com/twit. It's a lot of fun. Isn't there a Google connection with 23andMe? Isn't it?
It's familiar, it's Esther Wojcicki, of course.
Yeah.
It's Ann Wojcicki.
Ann Wojcicki, right? That's right.
Yeah. Ex-wife? Founded, no, sister-in-law?
Yes, ex-wife of Larry.
And Esther's daughter.
Okay. Esther's daughter.
And Susan's sister.
Yes.
The Wojcicki family is all
over. It's a 23andMe report in and of itself.
Because Susan Wojcicki runs YouTube. Esther's their mom who rented, and this is where the connection comes from. Correct me if I'm wrong, but she rented her garage to Larry and Sergey.
Right.
She runs the amazing journalism program at Palo Alto High.
Oh, neat.
Esther is just the greatest. Esther is just wonderful.
I love that whole family.
Oh, they're amazing. Yeah. So I also on 23andMe, in the research area, now that it has my genes, right, it asks me all these questions. Like the latest is, when a mosquito bites me, how big is the...
cool. Right?
So I spent I got fascinated with this, and I spent like 2 hours just answering questions. How often do you wear earplugs to help you get to sleep?
That's neat.
Never.
Yeah. By the way, I've just been handed this. Distaff is female. Agnate. A-G-N-A-T-E. Agnate is male. The male version of distaff. Thank you very much to our research team for coming.
And what does that mean? Like, distaff means agnate?
Spindle.
Spindle and agnate means some. Does it have another word?
A person descended from the same male ancestor as another specified or implied person, especially through the male line. See, as usual, guys, we get the great. Because we own the world. You might as well just get used to it. It's all about us.
Beyonce differ.
Hey, yes, but the women can slap our hands away when we get off Air Force One.
Everybody perfect. Oh, wow. I know. Oh, wow. Everybody knows that men are along for the ride that is women who are in charge, and we acknowledge that
please.
And admit it.
No. Let's not go here.
Nope.
Nice try, Leo, but you ain't buying it.
Watch.
Keep it to tech, Leo.
I know a genetic marker that's gonna get Stacy going. 45 teraflops TensorFlow processors, TPU. Oh, come on. You know you're excited.
I am. Wait, I thought this was super exciting from Google I/O. So I was like, everyone's like, blah, blah, no hardware. I was like, what are you talking about?
Very exciting.
They introduced the awesome thing. And so can we talk about machine learning and the AlphaGo game? Because
yes, if it's going on right now. Like, the AlphaGo is currently beating the best Go player in the world.
And for those of you who are like, wait, didn't it already do this? The cool thing about this version of AlphaGo is they re-architected it so it learned without humans. So it taught itself using only machine played games. So that's why this is pretty freaking cool.
So the first round went to AlphaGo by the smallest possible margin, half a point. Although you can't conclude much from that because AlphaGo is designed to just win. It can win by this. It doesn't need to win big. It just wins. Ke Jie is he's 19 years old. He's considered the best. I know he's Chinese. He's considered the best Go player in the world. Now, what's interesting, and I'd have to confirm this. Let me look at the DeepMind channel, see if there's been another game. Is there a second match already? I guess not.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything about a second match yesterday. I thought there was. I think it's best of five, and they're going to do team games too, which sounds really neat. But I didn't hear anything about anybody winning or losing last night.
Traditionally, you know, I'm a chess player, and of course, we chess players learned that machines were better than us a long time ago. Gary Kasparov, the world champion, was beaten handily by Deep Blue. AlphaGo is taking on a much more difficult challenge. Go has many more variations. It is a very subtle game. What's interesting, I don't know if this is true or apocryphal, but I've been told, I saw a story yesterday that the Chinese government was blocking this stream. They didn't want anybody in China to know that the best player in the world, a Chinese man, was being beaten by a machine. I don't know if that's true. You could see it's just a gripping exhibition, just nonstop action.
The commentator is pretty cool though. It's Michael Redman doing a lot of the commentary, and he did it for the first round of games. And
yes,
even if you know nothing about Go, which I don't, he did a pretty good job of kind of cluing people in about what is special about certain moves, and he'll regularly like tally up points and tell you who's winning, and it's fun to watch for a bit, at least.
No, I completely agree. And if you were to watch the whole thing, it would be 6 hours. They each have 3 hours to play the game. And that's a lot.
I would imagine that Google does a little faster.
Yeah, you can see the timer at some point. And AlphaGo had like 2 hours left when the other guy had none.
I think out of courtesy, purely out of courtesy, AlphaGo is taking 1 minute a move. I don't know if it's actually using all that time. It could be having a cigarette, you know, wandering around, drinking some juice.
Well, it continuously calculates even when it's not its own turn.
Right.
So it's going on and like crushing possibilities and just on and on and on. Yeah, you can see 2 hours left for AlphaGo and 39 minutes left for Ke Jie, or however you say it.
Ke Jie. You can't really, and by the way, that you can't underestimate that, because time pressure is a killer. And as you get short on time, you can lose if you run out. You will lose if you run out of time. So as you get short on time, you don't have the luxury of spending some time thinking about your move. The goal of the game is to occupy territory by surrounding the other player's pieces. You play white and black. It is a big board. There's a lot going on, and it's an ancient game with huge amounts of subtlety. I played it. But it completely defeats me. I was a pretty good chess player, but Go is another level entirely. It's an amazing.
And it's amazing hearing like some of the stuff Redman says about Go in the last year since AlphaGo started, like, it's already changing the game. And
yes.
Even the guy that was playing AlphaGo was changed his playstyle and was learning from AlphaGo already. Yeah, like it's amazing how receptive everyone is to the different playstyle of a computer,
which is different from chess. The chess community really doesn't like how computers play. They don't play like a human. And chess, you know, I guess in theory, Go is completely deterministic and calculable. Chess is much more so. Both are incredibly complex. But the computer is almost feels like a brute force machine when it's playing chess. And from what I hear these Go players say, AlphaGo is in some way making something beautiful. There's an aesthetic to what it's doing that is impressing the Go community in a very different way than the chess community.
Wow.
Yeah, reacted to Deep Blue.
Well, it may be the different ways they were. I mean, because chess was a brute force understanding of the rules, and that's
exactly.
it. But Go's learning from people and creating its own rules than originally, anyhow.
Yeah, you can't. I don't think you can brute force Go. I think there's too many possibilities. It's too complicated. So you have to really understand what's going on, and maybe it is more artistic. We live in interesting times, don't we?
I was like, I can play Clue and Gin Rummy. Neither artistically.
No. But Lisa always beats me at Gin Rummy. She has card sense. It's really interesting, actually. She's very good at numbers.
Is she a card counter?
She could, probably. But I think it's a gut and her just... She it's really interesting to watch her play because she always wins, even though it's a game of luck, right? But she always wins, and I think she really understands at a deep level what's going on. I'm paying attention. I'm not like it's not Go Fish, although I am very good at Go Fish. Did you read Steve Kovac?
Good to know.
Yeah, stay away from me on the Go Fish. Did you read Steve Kovac's interesting article about ATAP, Google's Advanced Technology Group?
I did not get a chance to, but I wanted to. Yeah. I had marked it.
Yeah. Well, good for you.
Well, I'm like, I was excited that we're talking about it on the show. That saves me from reading it.
Well, what's interesting is it's very much changed how it's run. I think much of Alphabet has under the stern gaze of CFO Ruth Porat. Steve quotes somebody involved with ATAP who said, "We're not pirates anymore. We're lowering the flag." Steve writes, "Instead of dreaming up far-fetched research and development projects, the ATAP group now functions more like a product division tasked with shipping market-ready goods."
I mean, ATAP announced so many like things that never really came to market. The one thing that made it was Project Tango. And
right.
I think they did the Motorola Spotlight videos where you can hold your phone.
I love
up
the Spotlight stories.
Oh, that's what they were. The Spotlight stories. Jacquard came out, but I don't know if it's actually for sale.
So that's part of the Loom Weave trio.
Yeah.
Weave is different, but yeah.
There's Brillo, there's Weave, there's Loom, and there's Jacquard.
No.
These are all home automation thingies, right?
No. Weave and Brillo. Brillo became Android Things. Weave is still a protocol, and that is home automation. But Jacquard was weaving conductive fibers into
fabrics.
Oh, that's
right. It was smart clothes.
It was a touchscreen. It was a touchscreen in a jean jacket, basically.
Yeah.
Well, a touch surface, not a screen.
That's dopey.
But other than that, they've had like five or six things that they've announced and demoed and never became projects or never became like products. They have the little like a tiny radar sensor that can like live on your wrist and you're supposed to be able to like gesture above a smartwatch.
Oh, yeah.
What else? There was Project Vault, which was like a little micro SD card with a tiny computer on it that would have like its own secure storage that you could control access to. There was Project Abacus, which used like the camera and location and your typing style and all sorts of stuff to like identify the user. So like Ooh, rather than a fingerprint,
yeah.
This would blaze up all of your phone sensors and use everything possible to try and identify you, which sounds like huge battery drain.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have to do a fingerprint because you would be authenticated just by using the device.
Yeah, like continuous authentication.
Yeah.
Actually launching this stuff hasn't really happened.
Remember Project Ara? Everybody loved this.
Right.
I thought it was dopey.
Oh, the modular surface.
Yeah, I thought it was dopey.
You did think it was dopey, yes.
Yeah. Rick Osterloh killed that. So Rick now is the man not in charge of ATAP, but the boss of the person in charge of ATAP. Rick, of course.
In charge of Google hardware.
He's in charge of all hardware. And, of course, he came...
Rick, where's my new Chromebook?
He came from Motorola, where he was very good, I think. Did a good job with the Moto X. But he killed Ara. He said no. Maybe they're going to... Yeah, where is your new Chromebook? You're going to get the Samsung Plus, Pro? The Pro?
I returned the Plus.
Yeah, the Pro is coming out now.
It was pokey.
The Pro is coming out tomorrow.
I remember you said the Pro is not going to be that much faster.
Well, that's my guess. I think it might be. It's an Intel chip instead of an ARM chip. That's the big difference.
Oh, so it'll suck more juice.
Be a little faster, but they need to get the software in order. And it's still going to launch with the software being beta and still not really finished.
You're talking about the Android store, the Play store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it still doesn't seem that great. They're still working on all of that. Apparently getting Android up and running on Chromebooks is very hard.
Apparently, among things, Steve did some great reporting. Steve Kovac did some great reporting. Among things that they're working on right now at ATAP, they did mention the Jacquard jacket that Levi's is doing. That was their first real standalone project. Supposed to launch this spring, but they hope it'll get out by the fall. They're also working on a handheld device based on the concept of affective computing, as an affect, as an emotion, a discipline focused on creating gadgets that can interpret and respond to human emotions.
Uh-huh.
One source referred to the project as similar to a smartphone, but without a screen.
These are crazy ideas. They're not necessarily good ideas.
Freescale had a series of sensors that they could use in a software package that ran on top of them that could tell the emotions of people. Like,
sounds like Microsoft Bob. I see you're crying. Would you like me to write a suicide note for you? That'd be useful.
Or Facebook's sentiment analysis.
Oh, you want to talk about that one? Holy cow. Let's take a break because this is going to get me angry. But we will have that in a moment.
Uh-oh.
You don't get a Leo rant very often. There's two rantable subjects today, net neutrality and this Facebook study. I'll let Stacey take that one. Stacey Higginbotham is here. Her podcast, Stacey on IoT, is with Kevin Toefel. You can find it at iotpodcast.com. She also does newsletters and is on the Twitter at GigaStacey. Ron Amadio from Ars Technica, where he covers Android. And I bet you get to cover anything you want because you're just the greatest.
Yes. We should still talk about car stuff. I just covered that.
We're not done with car stuff, and he's got more to say about that. Good. And, of course, Jeff Jarvis, we didn't expect you today. You got home early?
No, I was always supposed to be in here. No, I think actually, I know what happened. I was going to be in Ukraine right now, but I didn't go.
Okay. That's a Crimea. Our show. You know why I'm a little feisty today? I got a good night's sleep on my Casper mattress. That's why. You cannot downplay the
master. You are the master.
You cannot downplay the importance of a good night's sleep. I think we know now that is a big part of overall health, right? Not only do you just feel bad if you didn't get a good night's sleep, but really it can impact your physical health. It can make you sick. So get a great mattress, a mattress obsessively designed and made in the United States by Casper, made of supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that's just the right sink and just the right bounce. I don't know. It's kind of magical because, you know, you want a little give where your bony parts are, but at the same time, you want support for your back, and it does both. And because it's breathable, It sleeps cool, and you do not want a hot night's sleep. You want a cool night's sleep in it. Regulating your temperature through the night. Scientists are showing a lot of research that is a big part of overall sleep hygiene. A Casper mattress is going to last a long time. It's going to give you the support you want. There's no springs. That means no lumps, just comfort. And you can buy it online easily and risk-free. Because I know what you're thinking. You're saying, but if I buy online, how do I try before I buy? Well, I'll tell you, everybody knows trying a mattress in a mattress store is not any way to try anything. So get the Casper mattress. It comes in this great compact little box. You open it up and whoosh, smells fresh and clean, comfortable as can be. And then, get this, you have 100 nights to try it. 100 nights. If at any time, delivery is free, and if at any time during the 100-day period you say, yeah, I don't like it, they will come and get it and refund you every penny. Now, you can't beat that. Free shipping and free returns in the U.S. and Canada. Get your Casper mattress today. Really affordable because they eliminate the middleman. It makes it easy. Save an additional $50 on the mattress purchase, too, when you go to casper.com/twig. Please do that for us, will you? Use the promo code TWIG, casper.com/twig, promo code twig. Terms and conditions apply. $50 off your brand new mattress. You're going to love it. It makes you want to go to bed on time every night. See, I know I'm this way, and I know everybody listening this way. We're so excited about things in life, and they're just one more episode of The Wire. One more page of Reddit. Can I play one more game of Candy Crush? But no. No, you won't do that because your mattress is so, so, so comfortable. You just say, I can't wait to go to bed tonight. Oh, it feels so good. Casper.com/twig. And don't forget that offer code twig for $50 off. Ron Amadio, what did you write about? What did you do this time?
I spent the last year probably looking at car infotainment systems. So this is like the screens that are built into your car dashboard, and just kind of like the general mess of the
it is a mess
of the industry
it?
I feel like it's a lot like the smartphone market when it first started, where you have these companies that weren't making computers suddenly find themselves like having to make computers, and they're not like super great at it. So the question is, when will like the real software companies move in and start making car software? And Google actually announced that at Google I/O this week, where they showed off Android Automotive, which is an operating system that...
This is not Android Auto. This is not the your phone interface on a screen. This is your phone running the car.
Right. Android Auto runs on your smartphone and uses the car screen as like an external touchscreen monitor, basically.
Yeah.
This is exactly a copy of the phone model where Google sells licenses the software to OEMs, and they integrate it into their hardware. And in this case, the hardware is a car.
So a lot of cars use QNX, which is owned by BlackBerry.
Yes.
Ford used Microsoft Car for a long time for its Ford Sync and Ford Touch.
But they switched to QNX with Sync 3.
Right. So this competes with QNX then?
Yes. But also in the car market, some companies use Linux, which is almost always terrible because you have to do a lot of work to make Linux be good in a car.
And as you say, they're not good at software. They're car companies.
Right. And then some cars right now use Android. And this is companies like Honda and Hyundai, and this shows exactly why Google needs to be involved, because Honda, in their 2017 car, ships Android 4.2.
Oish. But they use it, in other words, they use it like, say, Amazon uses it. They use AOSP as the base for their car software, which they make themselves. But, you know, I'm not surprised to hear that's KitKat. I'm not surprised because what is the development cycle for cars? It's years.
Yes,
it's like 5 years.
That's the biggest problem. Yeah. Everything takes 5 years, and I looked at these cars like they were computers, which car journalists usually don't do. So I figured out what SoC was in them and what software they ran and stuff like that. And yeah, everything is 3 years old. Like these are all Tegra 3 NVIDIA processors from 2011. And it's almost like universally 3 year old or 5 year old.
There's good reason for that. For one, they've got to certify it. But two, you can't just put you wouldn't just put an Android device in a car. There's security issues, safety issues. There's driver distraction issues. This is non-trivial.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk about security issues, but Honda also ships a web browser from 2011, like the AOSP web browser.
Oh, please.
And I was trying it, and it won't even render like Ars Technica because it's so old.
Please don't put a browser in a car for any reason anyway.
And, Hyundai's worse. They ship Android 2.3 Gingerbread.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
But these are, I presume, heavily patched, right?
They're heavily modified. I don't think they're patched. I mean, the web browser is from 2011. Like, it's not
upgraded. They didn't update that.
So you could have all kinds of security issues with that.
So who's going to use Android Automotive?
It's Audi and Volvo. Okay. And yeah, the big deal about Google being involved is that, number one, you get up-to-date Android software. These were all running Android 7.0.
Wow.
And they're going to be upgraded to Android O before release. And then the other thing is you get Google apps. Like, all of these cars had Google Maps on board, which is amazing because everybody's built-in infotainment system is horrible. That was the other takeaway. Like, none of the car companies really want to do internet-driven maps. So what you end up with is totally local stuff, usually from Here Maps, which used to be owned by Nokia now owned by like Audi and BMW and somebody else.
My old Audi, my 13 Audi, maybe it's older than that, had Google Earth
Those were the ones with did you have a digital gauge and then have like a screen directly where the speedometer usually is?
No, this was on the side.
Oh, okay.
Audi A8. Yeah, I like what Audi's done. And now my Tesla has, I don't know what, Google Maps. Because it has satellite imagery as well as street imagery from Google Maps. But I'm not clear whether it gets its nav. So you can have the map, and then there's something that does the turn by turn, which could be Google or could be third party. And then there's something that does points of interest, and then does it get updated or not is another matter. So it's complicated, right?
Yeah, Tesla is another Linux-based one. It uses Google Maps, but it seems it's not the same as Google Maps on your phone. Like, it seems like it's old. It doesn't seem like it gets live traffic because it's different than your phone. Maybe it's delayed live traffic, and the directions are different. Like, everything's different. If you just hold up a phone and compare, everything's different between Google Maps on a Tesla and on a phone, probably because they don't want to use that much internet data.
Right.
But
they build LTE into the car, as did Audi.
Yeah. But you don't pay money for it a month, do
you? Tesla, you don't. Audi, I did. Audi, you get like a year free, but then you pay. Yeah.
Yeah. So Tesla probably doesn't want to use a ton of data because they're paying for that.
Right.
But the official like Google blessed Android software had like real Google Maps. Like, it's very heavily based on Android Auto. But kind of expanded to be a full operating system. So you get Google Maps, you get all of the Android Auto apps, which is another huge problem with cars today. Like, there's no app platform that runs across cars. Like, I remember in the days before Android, Larry Page complained where, like, Google, to do their mobile apps, needed to have, like, drawers full of cell phones in order to maintain these. And if you want the car version of that, Pandora has a page called Pandora in Your Car where they list 33 separate apps.
Oh, God.
And I assume to maintain that, they have a garage full of cars that they can dig through. And while a company like Pandora can do that, your standard, like, small-time app developer cannot afford to buy 33 different vehicles because everybody runs their own software, and it's just a huge mess.
Will this fix it? Will Android Automotive make this better?
Yeah, it's the Android Auto app platform, which limits you to audio apps, so like music and podcasts and stuff like that, and messages. And that's all you're allowed to do for safety reasons.
Right.
The Google makes the UI, and app developers just plug into the UI. So like every single audio app looks exactly the same.
Well, that's what you want. That's what Pandora wants. That's what Spotify wants, I presume.
But what's really cool about Android Auto is that the car manufacturers skin Android, but they also skin the app templates. So Spotify on the Volvo looks totally different than Spotify on the Audi, and it's the exact same app. But the thing they plugged into was skinned so that it looks like a perfect part of the infotainment system. It looked great. It was really cool looking.
So Jeff has resonates with him because you spent like 2 years looking for an Android Auto car.
And I gave up. Yeah, and part of the problem was that when I played with Android Auto on the phone, it was so limiting. It was so nanny-ish that I wasn't that crazy about it. I never got the full experience. And trying to find a car that had Android Auto and had what else I needed just didn't exist. I also was being picky in lots of ways. I needed four-wheel drive for 2 days a year in New Jersey. I did not want to pay for premium gas, so no car with a turbo, which took out a lot of them. And I ended up with a Mazda CX-5. I like the car very much. The UI sucks.
Does it have Android Auto or
no? Nothing like that.
But look this is Ron's picture from. Was this a show that you went to?
This was I/O. They had both cars on display.
So this is Spotify on Audi.
Yeah, that's the Audi.
And this is Spotify Volvo.
Yep. Exact same app, same code. Developer doesn't have to do anything. This just happens automatically.
But this is Volvo. You call it their accordion interface, which is kind of a weird, funky interface.
Yeah, the Volvo thing is very interesting because it looks exactly the way Volvo looks today. They just ripped out the underlying operating system and used Android. So from the consumer perspective, the difference is mostly going to be your software runs faster because it was made by a real software company, and you'll have a couple more apps at least.
Got Audible on here, though. That's good to me. That's good.
The big problem with Android Auto is there's still not that many Android Auto apps. Even like some really big media apps don't have Android Auto apps, and that makes it tough when you're stuck using Android Auto and it locks your phone out and everything else. But hopefully more developers will kind of get on board now.
So which do you think will be the best onboard entertainment system?
Right now, everything based on QNX was the nicest, which is like Audi and BMW and some other stuff. Just because QNX runs like a smartphone operating system in that it can do an animation and it will run at like a decent frame rate instead of the janky, stuttery mess that Linux usually is, and all the old, like the five-year-old Android that they had in these cars ran like a five-year-old Android device.
Yeah.
It was really bad.
Yeah, that's depressing.
So yeah, anything QNX ran really nice. And my favorite thing was the Audi because they took the dashboard, like they took the digital gauge cluster and stuck the map in it. So you had the infotainment system directly in front of the driver rather than like off to the side in the center of the car. And that's something I hope more companies do.
Yeah, this is nice. Actually, Tesla
does that.
Does a pretty nice job of it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Audi, so you can see in the dashboard the
So the that does not run Android. And that's a problem right now with the Android setup is that for safety reasons, those have to run a real-time operating system QNX. Like your speedometer is not allowed to lag because you're downloading a software update.
Right.
They were investigating ways to kind of project a map or whatever else they needed into that, which is usually a separate computer.
So why isn't Android Automotive a real-time operating system?
Well, because it's Linux and Android is not, and that's mess.
It's just too slow.
There is a way to converge those things. If you want some, it's called, I think this would be a solution. It's happening because this is a big problem in the industrial IoT, but it's, is it TSN, time sensitive networking? Ah. So it's a protocol that is an attempt to bridge old proprietary messaging systems, but you can also have an RTOS that's, you know, running on another computer somewhere and message using something that works with that over to Ethernet. So, and the automotive guys are actually really interested in this. So there you go.
And Google does have a real-time OS under development. That's Fuchsia.
Fuchsia.
We don't have to get into that.
No, but that explains why they're doing Fuchsia.
That explains why they're doing it then.
Yeah, there's been a lot of questions. Like, what do you need with a third operating system? That explains it. How far along is Fuchsia?
It's been in development for a year and a half. So
not long.
If you follow Android's development, that took about 5 years.
Yeah.
So give them about 3.5 years, and we'll see.
Wow.
Fuchsia is based on a microkernel called Magenta that's derived from Little Kernel.
Which, it's all Google-developed. Like, it's a Google-developed kernel with a Google-developed operating system running a Google-developed programming language. So they're just kicking everybody out the door, and they're not going to deal with any upstream stuff. And it's all Google, and nobody really knows what they're going to do with it. They have a smartphone like demo concept UI that you can download. But other than that, who knows?
We're talking to the guy who wrote the book on Fuchsia, by the way. So we got the Fuchsia expert here.
I think it's really overhyped just because it's so not finished. And like, if you look at what Android looked at when they released their first emulator, that was back when it was a BlackBerry clone. And like, imagine if before the G1 came out, you spent all this time, you know, theorizing about the BlackBerry Android clone and what it did and how it worked and all that. Like, it's so early right now that I am not too worried about Fuchsia. Like, I'll peek at it once in a while, but it does seem like a replacement for Android eventually one day. Like, they straight up say it's going to run on smartphones. Oh, yeah, they say it's designed to run on a modern smartphone and on a modern desktop computer. But like all projects inside of Google, they run multiple competing things at once. It has nothing to do with the Android team. I don't think it's going to merge with Android or anything. They do these competing projects, and some of them die. And Fuchsia could easily die and never see the light of day. It's something that, like I said, it's like 3 years out. So just relax and don't get too hyped up about
it. It's still open source, though, which is great. BSD 3, MIT, and Apache 2 licenses, not GPL. But
yeah, they get to get rid of the GPL. That's interesting.
Yeah, although these other licenses are highly respected in the open source community. So it's not – that's – I mean, at least they're doing an open source operating system. I think they understand how to do that. But it takes a long time.
I think if you want to like read the tea leaves on Flutter, on Fuchsia, the thing to look out for is Flutter, which is Google's SDK for Fuchsia. Like, Fuchsia should probably be called Flutter OS. So Flutter is an SDK that you program in with the programming language Dart that Google invented. There's so many code names for this stuff. It's ridiculous. Flutter apps run on Android, iOS, and Fuchsia.
Ah.
So if you see Google push developers to use Flutter, then that is the transition point to Fuchsia, because they're telling people, when you hear the word Flutter, that means write a Fuchsia app. And you can do that today, and it will run on Android and iOS. And in the future, if they ever release this operating system, it'll run on that too.
And Stacy will like this. The system UI for Fuchsia is called Armadillo.
Woo!
Oh.
Yeah. They have a lovely little drawing there. That guy is definitely on the art team.
Spent some time doing that in a Bic ballpoint pen. That's nice.
And now Google Draw can turn it into a real armadillo like that.
Yeah.
So because it runs on Android, you can download Armadillo and get it up and running on your phone, which is where I got the screenshots.
Oh. Very bare bones. They got a long way to go, obviously.
It doesn't even work. Like, nothing works at all. None of the sliders work. The buttons don't really work. The multi-window thing is crazy. Like, you can just drag apps on top of each other, and it'll do a multi-window split. And then you can just keep going until it crashes, and you have, like, 8 multi-window splits where it's, like, you know, horizontal and vertical lines and tiny little columns, and everything's this big. So it seems powerful. It's just nowhere near finished.
It takes a long time to do an OS. These are not.
Yes.
These are non-trivial things. Do you know how many people are working on it?
Not a bunch. Double-digit numbers. I checked.
Okay, well, that's a lot of people. You can't get too big. You can't, you know, as we know from the Mythical Man Month, you can't just throw programmers at it and solve it. It just takes that long. Thank you for explaining that, Ron. I've been wondering what fuchsia was all about for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't know.
I think we even referenced him when we talked about it last time.
Oh, we did. Like, we did. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. We should ask Ron.
Need Ron here.
We should get Ron on. That's probably why you're here. How come Android is still taking so long to get on Chromebooks and not...
I think Ron can explain that too.
Can you explain that, Ron?
Well, on the Chromebook Pro, that's Intel-based, and that's a little harder than the ARM-based Plus, the Samsung Chromebook Plus.
So it's still in beta on the Pro.
Yeah. Like I was saying, it's still not done. Like I think they just got it up and running on Android 7.0 Nougat, but it still doesn't do things like take advantage of the multi-window API. So like apps aren't resizable.
And that's really ugly. I've played with that on my Chromebook. It just looks like you got a phone app in portrait mode on your screen. It just doesn't. It's as bad as the Android tablet experience was.
Yeah, there's a ton of bugs right now. It seems to be a lot better now than it was when Chromebook Pro review units went out in February. They're trying to like make Android run on top of Chrome OS in a container thing, and it's just really complicated. And it was never supposed to be easy, and it's just taking way longer than they expect. And that's why you see the Chromebook Pro get delayed. They're all just waiting for the software to be finished.
Paul Thurrott had a good article about all of this and why it's taken so long. Do we know why? So apparently all Chromebooks that are sold this year will eventually have access to the Play Store. But it seems a kind of mystery which ones don't. For instance, why the Pixel 1 will not and the Pixel 2 will. Both have touch. Both are very powerful machines with lots of RAM.
Isn't it that the Pixel is end of life? The Pixel
is that it? It's just not. They're just not going to spend any energy on it.
Yeah, it's just not supported.
Okay.
It probably matters what version of Linux you use and what and what underlying software is there. And they probably just want to kill the old Pixel because probably no one uses it. I imagine they sold a very small amount.
You know who uses it? Jason Howell uses it.
yeah, I saw him with that.
He's the last man standing.
Yeah.
So what should Jeff do? Because he wants a Chromebook. But I was saying wait for the Asus C302A that has
probably the one.
The i7 and the 16 gigs of RAM. But that's
no pen.
That would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, no I don't pen, know the specs. Xbox. I don't know the specs for the Chromebook Pro.
Didn't you look? You talked about it on ours. I thought you didn't look at it. You didn't get one. Comes out.
I just don't.
Comes out in 3 days, 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, that would be cool to play with.
I love the Chromebook Plus. Jeff got it on my recommendation. I'm sorry, and didn't like it.
Oh, so the Pro was a Core M3.
Right.
What was the Asus one?
They said they were going to have. I think I don't know if it'd be a mobile part. Probably would be an i5 or an i7.
Jeez.
But nobody's seen hide or hair of it. I mean, they announced it so long ago.
Yeah, all
C320?
Of those are
302.
Because the software is not done.
It's a flip. Right. It's a 2-in-1, very similar to the Samsung.
Yeah, I can't do Chromebooks because I don't do Photoshop, so I'm just at a. I'm out of luck there.
You can't do Chromebooks because you do Photoshop?
Yeah, they don't have Photoshop. And I
need
Photoshop. All sorts of work. Yeah.
It says it's a Core M3. Does that tell you enough?
No, that's the current one. So the current one is
the Asus C302CA.
Yes, is the current one is an M3. But they have teased that they're going to do a faster one.
Oh, I see.
I thought it was an i7, but I may be wrong on that.
Okay.
And it's probably still a mobile, but still. And 16 gigs of RAM, which is even more
important. That's the key. And I wish it would do LTE. Yeah. You know, so I don't know how miserable would I be with a Microsoft Surface.
I don't think you'd be all that miserable, to be honest with you.
Well, I'm always miserable.
What's changed is that we don't really use the operating system anymore. You could use a Microsoft, a Windows tablet like you use a Chromebook. Just keep Chrome full screen running, and you would never see Windows.
Yep. Yeah, I'm the same way. I have a Windows computer and a Mac laptop, and switching doesn't bother me because I use Chrome and Dropbox and Photoshop.
I think that's increasingly the case. Yeah, and if you use Adobe applications, it doesn't matter. I'm actually bringing a Windows laptop on my trip because I'll just be using Lightroom and Chrome. And I wanted something powerful and light. And I like to, I don't know why, but I like that two-in-one fold-over thing. Because you can tent it and watch a movie on the plane. And you can use it as a tablet. And you can also use it as a laptop. I just like that. I don't like detachable screens. And that's why I don't
like the problem I'll have.
I don't like the Pro because it's the Surface is detachable, right? It's just really a tablet with a flimsy little keyboard that sticks on it.
Yeah, laptops are tough right now since Apple did the whole MacBook thing. The next one is supposed to have a better battery, which would be super great.
Yep.
But right now it's tough.
Jeff, we don't know what to do for you. You know, you might, look at the Surface laptop. You know what? Here's a wild one. Use the Surface laptop, which comes with Windows 10 S, which is kind of like, it's like the Chromebook of Windows. You can only use apps that are in the store. It's very light. It's very portable. You can get it.
Yeah, the Windows Store has such a great browser selection.
Well, no, you have to use Edge. You can't use Chrome, and that's kind of a...
Oh, well, defeats it.
That's it. You have to have Chrome, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, you can...
Plus, I have my Google Play, and I have my Netflix, and my HBO Go.
Well,
Showtime Go. Showtime beats the heck out of HBO because I can download.
Both of those, I think, are available in the Windows Store. However, if you buy the Surface laptop... Now you can upgrade it to Windows 10 Pro for free. I don't know.
I just think I'll probably bombard the show with complaints and whining.
I know
if I buy
will. But you'll love the luxurious.
I'll blame you for it.
Rich Alcantara material covered keyboard. You'll love that. It's got a fabric fabric.
Ew. No.
Yes.
No. How do you clean that with alcohol then?
You don't.
Oh, no.
It's made
I really wonder how that will age.
Space age materials.
No.
No, Stacey's.
Ew. Are you a germaphobe, Stacey? Is this something we didn't
know? I'm not a germaphobe, but dear God, keyboards they're filthy.
Clearly, looking at her office, she's a mesophobe.
Yes? You could use a Clorox wipe on it. I don't think that would hurt it. It's plastic, basically. Alcantara is polyurethane and polyester. It's not.
Isn't that what Tesla has as their header inside
yes,
the car?
Headliner is
okay.
Alcantara.
Headliner, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Only if you upgrade to the finest things in life.
Finest Corinthian headliner.
Yeah. It's Corinthian Alcantara. Yes. So Mark Zuckerberg says, I am not using this trip to run for office. Some of you have asked, he writes on Facebook on Sunday, if this 50 states in a year challenge means I'm running for public office. I am not. I'm doing it to get a broader perspective, to make sure we're best serving our community of almost 2 billion people at Facebook and doing the best work to promote equal opportunity at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. So there.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah. Everybody's not running for president.
I don't think he's running for office. I just don't think. I think he couldn't bear politics.
Yeah, I can't see Mark Zuckerberg really enjoying politics. God.
Did you see him live streaming his visit to his Harvard?
No, I missed it. I saw it was up there. Was it funny?
His wife, Priscilla, because Priscilla was his girlfriend, despite the movie. Priscilla was his girlfriend in college. Why am I not getting audio? Is that me? Oh, it's your fault? Okay. It's not your fault. 6.5 million views of Mark at his old first time he'd visited his Harvard dorm room since he invented Facebook. And by the way, yes, there was an old beer that was he'd left there some years ago. Here it is. H33. Do you know where this is, Karsten? Yeah, it's the jock dorm. It's the jock dorm, really?
Yeah.
Was Mark a jock? Huh.
It explains his love of the Adidas flip-flops.
Yeah. He went to visit his high school, and then he went to visit his old dorm room. I've done that. Have you done that, Karsten? It's kind of fun. Go see your old dorm room. No, too many bad memories. What house were you in?
Adams.
He was in Adams. Which house is this? You were in the artsy house? By the way, age 33 is now considered the most coveted dorm room in America. Because Mark Zuckerberg was there.
They didn't enshrine his dorm room and like preserve it.
It's unchanged since Mark was here.
When he gives $1 billion, yeah, they'll do that.
His math formulas like are still on the window where he wrote them. Well, that's a good use of Facebook.
The social graph.
That's a good use of Facebook Live. I think that's kind of cool.
So when is his address?
Age 33.
So when is his commencement address?
Oh, is he speaking? Oh, that's why he's there.
That's why he's there, yeah.
He's speaking,
I can't wait.
Harvard.
Remember we showed the Bill Gates,
yeah,
Zuckerberg,
yeah, mantra. Now I have some audio now. Can you hear it now? What is wrong with me? Why have I failed you? I failed you in so many ways. It's probably me. It's just me. It's just Windows. My sound is on. Sending it out the HDMI port. All right. We don't have to share our private family troubles with the rest of the world.
The students who live here during the year have moved out by now. So the folks who are here now are basically, yeah, they're Harvard has this program where they allow students who haven't graduated yet. So these guys are, I guess, rising juniors to come live in the dorms and help out crew with all the events and activities, which are going on over the next. Cards. That's this is what Harvard does, right? It's like you get the Harvard cards. So you guys are what? You're rising juniors and seniors. You know, we just met right before this. You want to introduce yourself and tell them what?
No.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, Priscilla, do you have any stories from this suite from 13 years ago?
He's gotten pretty good at this. This is pretty good.
None that I should tell.
The overlap between the overlap that we have between stories that are good. Stories that I'm not already going to share at commencement in 2 days, and stories that are reasonable to tell on a live stream with 100,000 people watching is very small.
Yeah, let's just say I was 18 when you were in this room, and people should be allowed to move on from things that happened when they were 18 years old.
That's ironic, that's nice, considering Facebook's business.
We'll never let you move on. Zing. Everything you do is now memorialized. For future. Private chat rooms have been added to Facebook Live, so that'll help people do the right thing. Amazon has hired James Gosling. We had a great interview with James. He's the inventor of Java when he was at Sun Microsystems. Told some good stories about that on Triangulation some months ago. He is now going to work as, he's got a good title. Senior special heavyweight person. What is his title? Oh, I can't find it. He was
distinguished engineer.
He was, when we talked to him, he was working distinguished engineer. Yeah, there you go. He was working designing underwater robots when we talked to him. Remember that? That was cool. Distinguished engineer.
I don't actually know if that's somewhere.
His title.
I think it is though. Something like that. Yeah. Sorry.
They're hiring older people, and that's a good thing.
Oh, that's my friend, James Governor from Red Bunk.
That's who it was.
Yeah, he's a smart dude. And yes, I was pulling up his thing so I could see. His blog post was on AWS demolishing the cult of youth over at Red Bunk.
Good.
And it talked about them hiring Adrian Cockcroft and how James Hamilton, who, if you've never seen him present, he's hilarious, and he's like 51, and he's still sporting his mullet, so.
51's not that old. Not that old.
Sorry, he's in his 50s. Oh, and they talked about Tim Bray being hired there.
Oh, I love Tim Bray.
There you go. He's 61 now.
Tim's 61. Wow. I always think
that's,
of him as,
that's according to this.
As a youngster. Hackers have defeated the iris scanner in your Galaxy S8. The Chaos Computer Club in Germany has figured out how to simulate your iris. This is the same group that bypassed Apple's Touch ID system in 2013. A camera with a 200-millimeter lens, a long telephoto lens, can capture a usable picture of your iris from up to 16 feet away. And at that point, you can print it out with a laser printer. Ironically, the best results on a Samsung laser printer. Then you place a contact lens on top of the print to mimic the curvature of a real eye.
That's awesome.
That is great thinking. Once
you, all of this face-based, all of this face-based security, you know, the face unlock thing that Samsung did and was also broken, and the eyeball thing. It's like, it's really weird because there's a lot of pictures of people's faces on the internet. Like that's the number one thing that's going to be out there. It seems like a really weird thing to base your security around. Whereas, like a fingerprint, there's way less fingerprint pictures out there.
Yeah, although, so they're taking with just a point and shoot from just a kind of medium distance. They don't really need to get in close. See, that's good enough. They're taking his picture. Then they're printing it out. And then I guess they're going to put a contact lens on it. That's kind of
So is what you're saying is that any photo of somebody that already exists, this could be done with?
Yeah. Look, see, they got a contact lens. Got to get the eye the same size.
That's a pretty high-res picture.
Well... Okay. Does it? I don't. Whoa. Look how fast that unlocked it. Wow. That's the beauty of that, by the way, that iris recognition is really fast, even if it's not very safe. The folks.
Well, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, right. I would use a long password would be the best thing.
It's the kind of thing that like a targeted VIP would fall victim to, but not necessarily like your average phone thief.
Yeah. No. But yeah, I mean, if you're a public figure or whatever.
Leo's concerned.
I'm always concerned.
However, I bet I could get Trump's iris pretty easily.
Yeah.
You know, like somebody like that.
Like a post-it note, you know, it's easy. Yeah. I am interested in what 1Password is doing. They're one of the most popular password vaults out there, and they've created a new travel mode.
This is what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Designed for travelers. So the idea is you will designate the passwords that are okay to reveal. It's marked safe for travel, and then everything else will get deleted before you get off the plane. It'll be removed from your device in every respect possible. But don't worry, because 1Password still has your password vault, and they'll restore it when you get home.
So can the authorities force you to restore it?
No, because they say there's no way of knowing travel mode is there.
Except now.
So wait, so is the implementation like they won't see my Facebook app that's on my phone when they ask me to open it?
No, the apps are still there. It. Yeah,
but they then. They're going to ask me to open it, and then I'll just be like, I can't because I don't have access to my passwords.
Say my password's on, I don't have my passwords.
Okay. Could they hold me in contempt of court?
You know, I'm going to test this in a couple of weeks, and I'll let you know. I'm a little nervous.
I think what you say is I forget.
I forget?
And then you're good. Rather than no, I'm not going to unlock it, just I forget.
Don't say no. Don't ever lie. Just say, I don't know it. It's at home. It's in my password vault at home.
Didn't we discuss a legal case that had a guy who declined to give his password because he had child pornography on his computer?
Right, the judge said you have to.
So is that a worrying precedent we should look to when we look at this?
That's the problem is the courts are not in agreement on this.
Will 1Password pay your legal fees if you want to be the test case?
I don't think so. FCC, let's talk about net neutrality.
You've got 8 minutes.
I got 8 minutes? All right, let's not.
Of my time.
I'll just tell you a couple of things that make me mad. One, if you went to Go FCC yourself, John Oliver's site because you wanted to comment on this. Let's see if it's working now. The FCC pulled down the public comments because they say they were DDoSed, but then they would give no evidence that they were DDoSed. Nope, it's back up. Good. So they've put those comments back on. So if you go FCC yourself, please do it while you can. There's also some evidence of astroturfing going on. People, internet service providers using your name to pretend that you're against net neutrality. I hate net neutrality. And then, Jeff, I imagine you're a little miffed by the story of John M. Donnelly, who's with CQ Roll Call and is also chairman, ironically, of the National Press Club's Press Freedom Team. He was booted out of FCC headquarters because he had the temerity to ask questions of the FCC commissioners
in a government-owned building, and was accused of you know, kind of violating the privacy of the FCC head. It's just ridiculous. These people work for us, but they don't realize it. I'm gonna get in trouble from somebody on Twitter. Oh, you brought politics into the show.
Excuse me. I brought it into the show, and I don't care.
He was walking up after a commission meeting and just was trying to talk to him like
politely.
Yeah. I mean, having been to the FCC and done similar things, this is not terrible behavior.
The good news is Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico and Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire sent a letter to Ajit Pai one day later questioning this behavior. They said in their letter, the FCC should set a sterling example when it comes to supporting the First Amendment and freedom of the press. Yesterday's incident is not an isolated one. It seems to be a part of a larger pattern of hostility toward the press, which underscores our serious concern. It's just a letter. No investigation, no committee has been formed, but nevertheless. And then in England, the Tories platform, they call it their manifesto. You know that Theresa May and the Tories she called an election. They're up for election. And the Tory platform is, here's a line towards the end of the platform. Some people say it is not for the government to regulate when it comes to technology and the internet. We disagree. But it's not just the Tories. Apparently the liberals are also kind of pro, you know, let's shut the internet down because it's full of bad stuff. If they win their seats, legislation will be introduced to protect the public from abuse and offensive material online, and everyone would have the right to white material.
In other words, protect the public from the public.
Yes. And the right to forget? Yes, you'll have the right to white material that was posted when you were under 18. Mark Zuckerberg would like that. Priscilla Chan would like that. Internet companies would also be asked to help promote counter-extremism narratives. New rules requiring companies to make it harder for people to access pornography and violent images. All content creators are forced to justify their policies to the government. Labor's doing the same thing. So if you live in the UK, well, brace yourself.
No Europe, no internet. Wow. Australia's talking about a Google tax.
Ugh. Let's do a quick ad because I want Stacy to give us her pick of the week. Our show today brought to you by our good friends at Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. The best mortgage lender in the country has made that even better because now you can do the mortgage approval process completely online. If you're going to buy a new home and you got to get a mortgage, or if you're going to refi your existing home, you want to go to a lender not only that you can trust, and of course Quicken Loans is the best, but also one that's transparent, that helps you make the right decisions and makes it easy. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can share the financial info you need to get approval. And by the way, because it's all on computers, you can do it on your phone, on your tablet, on your computer. It's turn it around in minutes. Last time we bought a house, it took a month to get the loan from that big bank. Next time, believe me, Rocket Mortgage. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the solution that's right for you. Skip the bank. Skip the waiting. Go completely online. QuickenLoans.com/twig for Rocket Mortgage. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. And MLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030. We thank Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans for their support for This Week in Google. Go to Quicken Loans, and maybe you're not buying right now, but make a note of this. Quickenloans.com/twig. Stacy, you got 2 minutes to give us your thing.
Awesome. Ta-da!
What is that?
She's ready for us.
I keep them right here. This is the Wemo dimmer switch. This just came out. Okay, so the good thing is Wemo has had a light switch for a long time.
So you show us the Lutron before and recommended that, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
does this do Leo, the same thing? Yes,
this is a dimmer, except it doesn't require a hub.
Oh.
But it's $80, which is kind of expensive for a Wi-Fi dimmer switch, because I have the box for it. I don't have the light switch. I also have the Leviton Wi-Fi dimmer switch that's only about $45 or $50.
Yikes.
So, but if you're already in the Wemo world, this is nice. It's pretty. I haven't installed it yet. That's happening this weekend, but I will show you.
It is pretty. I like the night mode. It glows.
It does.
Yeah.
So here we are back in the light switch. You need a neutral wire for this, so keep that in mind. And here's the front. It's not a, what's the word I want here? You don't. It doesn't click like a normal toggle switch. There's a little bit of give here, but it's not like on off kind of clicky.
It's more like you run your finger along it.
Uh huh. Like, and this is a touch thing.
Like wiping a tear from a baby's eye. Just like that.
So, Stacey, this is your leaving. I also want to hear your thoughts on the IKEA stuff.
What about the IKEA stuff? That it's.
So the fact that they're going to have a whole line that's compatible with both Home and Amazon?
IoT Home Lighting.
Yes.
It's going to be called
Trad-free.
So we've talked about this, haven't we? I had a month ago I had IKEA on my show. So the guy who's in charge of all of this. So if you want details,
does this support like Zigbee or is it its own standard or?
Trodfi is the current product or Zigbee with the hub that'll convert it. It's like $80 for the hub and I think two light bulbs.
Interesting.
You can buy them at your local IKEA now. You can't buy them online. And they're all right. They're not.
Of the Lutron, Leviton, and Wemo, which do you like the best? Or do you not have enough information?
I haven't installed this Wemo switch. Right. I hated the original Wemo switch, but Wemo's done a lot of work on their software. I also hated it because it was a smart switch with no dimmer, which was just stupid.
Okay, go get your daughter. She's waiting on the curb wondering where mommy is.
Yeah, they start charging me if I'm late.
What?
Gotta go.
Oh, man.
They gotta keep someone there for her. All right, bye, you guys. Thank you.
Bye, Stacey. IoTpodcast.com. Stacey.
Bye, Stacey.
Bye, Stacey. Bye, Stacey. And now it's time for Jeff's number.
Ron. No, I lost mine.
It's time for Ron. Ron's thing. Hi, Ron.
Okay. This just arrived like 2 hours ago, and I'm super excited about it, but I don't know that much about it right now. Do you remember the old Optimus keyboards from Art?
Art Lebedev.
So they were these really cool keyboards that had like LCDs.
And OLEDs on the keys.
The keys. And what somebody actually made a real-life one. That you can actually buy that works. Let me get a little more.
Oh, this is from Elgato. They used to make Mac stuff.
Yes, this is the Elgato Stream Deck. And the name Stream Deck is because it's for like Twitch streamers. But screw that. I'm going to turn it into a productivity device. So like all these are all keys here. And you can press buttons and the whole thing will change.
$150.
Yeah, it's $150. And the Optimus version of this was like $1,000 and you could never ever buy one. And I always like lusted after the pictures on the internet, but like this thing came out in March. And the little keys are great. Like it seems to be working awesome. The only problem I have with it is that the software is for like Twitch streamers. So it doesn't do a lot of things.
It's designed for OBS Studio or Tippy Stream and stuff like that. Yeah.
But what you can do is run EXEs. So I'm just making auto hotkey scripts and binding them to all the buttons. So I can do things like paste text. Like one of the things I do all the time when I'm writing is link to past articles. and a lot of stuff is very like foundational, like the major Android OS reviews. And I can just have that on a button that says link this text as the Android review or link this text as the last phone review or whatever. So like with Auto Hotkey, which is a bunch of programming, I can have it be
like Auto Hotkey.
Clipboard or open
website.
This
is interesting because really what it is to kind of give a big time TV switcher capabilities to online streamers. It's kind of
yes.
Neat. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're willing to do the programming work, I think it's going to be an awesome little productivity device. And the best thing is this little stand that can
nice.
Pop out and it can kind of sit up like this on your desk.
You got to come back and give us a review after you've played with
it. Yeah, I showed this to the guys in Slack and they're like, so when is your review? And I'm like, I guess.
Crap.
I guess I should write about it.
Now
sure.
More work.
Yep. Yep.
You'll find Ron's great work at ArsTechnica.com, and he's on Twitter, Ron Amadio, and it's always great to see you. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today, Ron. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And finally, Jeff Jarvis, did you find your number?
So I had a link. No, I've lost it. I had a link. It was fascinating, but I can't find it again, about how Street View is 10 years old. And there were some great links in there about how artists are using it, and I can't find it now.
Oh, you pasted a different link in, yeah.
I pasted the wrong thing into the, I did with two links. I don't know how I did that, but I did it. So I messed up.
It does it to me all the time. 10 years old? Is it really 10 years old?
10 years. That's what the story said, if I can find it.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. It seems like it.
Wow. Yeah.
That was
it the Conversation US?
Here it is from The Guardian. How about this? No, that's Google Maps. That's an
how
old
Google
story.
Street View became fertile ground for artists?
Mm. Yes.
Fertile. Yes. Okay. Fertile. That's the key word.
Where'd you find it? New Atlas?
Google. It's the conversation.com?
Get the conversation.
Oh, it's look, the conversation.
Yeah.
Okay.
10th anniversary.
There we go. Wow. Yes, that's it. Thank you.
Wow.
So there's various artist things up there where they found all this amazing thing. You click anywhere.
The nine eyes of Google Street View. Wow. Wow. Oh, my God. So those cars drive around. You could see. Oh, there's twins. You could see why the Germans are nervous about all this. Interesting. Is that fun or what? What?
It's snapshots of life. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is one of many, many art pieces linked to from this, theconversation.com, a series of unfortunate events. Look, a van fire. Michael Wolf did this. That's cool. He got an honorable mention in the World Press photo competition for photographs he took from Street View. That's funny. That's funny. This is cool.
Well, yeah, it is cool. So, Ron, what did you search for to find it? I was searching for the last 5 minutes.
I searched for whatever words you said on Twitter. It was Street View 10 Artist. Google
oh, thank
Foo.
You.
By the way, and from this, I have learned that Street View blurs not only human faces, but bunny faces.
Well, when that is the press secretary of the President of the United States.
Yeah, it's Sean Spicer in that bunny outfit. Yep, yep, selling shoes, apparently. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis, Google. He's at CUNY, where he's a distinguished professor of journalism at the, is it the Tau Knight Center? Did I get, do I?
Knight Center.
Knight Center. Yes, there's right. No Tau. Just Knight. And he's
so Tau Knight Center.
How, Tau Knight at the Center. Tau Knight. How is it going with that Facebook initiative that Craigslist?
Facebook and Craigslist. Yeah. I mean, Craig Newmark and Philanthropies and Ford and six other supporters. Well, we're going to announce our managing director tomorrow, somebody who's just great.
Oh, good.
And then we get rolling. Big
how
time. We're also, I think it's already been out publicly. Gave a matching grant to Jimmy Wales Wiki Tribune. And just while we were on the show practically, they met their crowdfunding goal.
Oh, well, that's nice. And I gave them a little bit of money. With 8 hours left, 10 out of 10 journalists funded.
So they've funded 10 journalists, which is a big deal. So we gave to that, and we're going to announce a couple other grants.
That's a good grant.
Yeah.
That's a great grant. The idea is journalists will work with crowdsource editors and fact checkers and all sorts of stuff to create stories at wikitribune.com. I like that. New models for journalism. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I appreciate it. We do this show every Wednesday afternoon, about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to stop by, you can watch us live at Ustream, Twitch, YouTube. You can also watch us at our website and choose from those streams at twit.tv/live. If you're doing that, you might as well go in the chat room at irc.twit.tv and participate in the behind-the-scenes conversation. We always love it when you're there. You can even join us in studio. Glenn came by. Nice to see you, Glenn. If you want to visit us, just email tickets at twit.tv so we can put a chair out for you. However, most people I know listen to the show whenever they want, on demand, after the fact, and that's easy to do. You could subscribe in your favorite podcast application. Just look for This Week in Google or go to our website, twit.tv/twig. So glad you were here, and I hope you'll come back next week. Thanks for joining us, and I'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.